This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, how sexual harassment and assault in the workplace spawned the hashtag MeToo movement on social media. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. It all started back in October 2017 with accusations of harassment and assault against Harvey Weinstein, a famous Hollywood film producer. He was fired from the Weinstein Company, which he co-founded and of which he was CEO, after several women publicly accused him of sexual misconduct stretching back decades. Since then, dozens of prominent men in show business, journalism, and politics have been accused of sexual harassment and have been sacked or stepped down. The MeToo hashtag has been widely used on Twitter by women and a few men whose harassers were not famous enough to make the news. Some analysts say that the MeToo movement is laying the groundwork for two major cultural shifts. One is the acceptance that sexual harassment, not just sexual assault, is unacceptable in the workplace. The other is that when a powerful person is accused of sexual harassment, the reaction might be a presumption that the accuser is likely telling the truth, as the risks of going public are great. Well, with us to discuss the origins and implications of the MeToo movement for the United States and globally are two distinguished analysts. Laurie Adams is the director and CEO of Women for Women International. That's a global organization dedicated to promoting gender equality and helping women victims of war. And Shelby Quast. She's the director of Equality Now, and that's a nonprofit organization that promotes women's rights around the globe and seeks to end gender-based violence and discrimination. And both women join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Carol. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Carol. It's great.
Well, Laurie Adams, let me begin with you and just quickly remind our listeners what triggered the MeToo movement and how significant is it in your view?
Well, actually, the first use of the hashtag that we know about was back in 2006 with an activist out of New York called Tarana Burke. She's representative for me of the fact that there have been women on the ground organizing to support women survivors of violence for hundreds of years, often not in the public eye. And so then when the hashtag was taken up by actress Alyssa Milano, it went viral. And that's what really encouraged lots of other people to join in. Now, then other actresses joined in, including Ashley Judd, who's one of the supporters of Women for Women International. She's traveled to our program, and she was one of the people who came out against Harvey Weinstein, along with many other ones. And one of the questions we have is, okay, so why now finally has this gone to prominence? Is it because the women in the film industry are now actually powerful enough? Is there a tipping point of power where the women have enough power to confront the power that has been over them? Is it because our decades of organizing work are paying off? What is it that has allowed us now to take this viral and really start to see consequences, start to see people in the media, as well as celebrities, as well as in businesses, and even in NGOs, held to account for sexual harassment and abuse? And we here at Women for Women International, and I think Equality Now as well, are interested in making sure that we see that same accountability all around the globe.
Well, let me now turn to Shelby Quast for your take on what triggered this movement and why now, and do you see this as a tipping point?
I think to echo what Laurie was saying is this has been going on for a long, long time. And I think part of the fact is the platform that women celebrities took that platform and spoke out. And oftentimes when we see, to be quite candid, a white, well-off woman speaking about this and challenging somebody who's also a white male often, and we look at the racial implications. We know this has been happening around the world. And Laurie again mentioned Tarana Burke, who started this movement, and she said something interesting to me. She said, "I've been saying this for years, and people weren't interested in what I had to say. Ah, but now there's a new platform, and you bet I'll stand up and begin to use my voice again and make sure that we're addressing these issues." So I think part of it is there is a new platform, and people are taking advantage of that platform to have their voices be heard, both in the United States, but also around the world. And it's not just actresses, as you're saying, not just politicians, but we're seeing it in sexual assault in the military, the Me Too military. We're seeing it in sexual assault Congress, you know, Me Too Congress. Women are starting to speak out, especially staffers. We're seeing it with sexual assault on campus. And it's a really large movement, and people are just telling their story that they've been telling for quite some time, but on a new platform.
Well, thank you for your excellent responses. Let's move on to what exactly we're talking about, sexual harassment. And I think I'd like to split it up into two categories. You know, we have women subjected to annoying and inappropriate speech and unwanted touching, oftentimes, with no specific consequences, let's say, to her job. But then there's this sexual harassment and the use of intimidation and coercion by the harasser, as we saw in the case of Harvey Weinstein, and as we see, as you said, in many cases that are less well known around the world. So sexual harassment, the use of intimidation and coercion by the harasser because he has power over the victim. Talk about how you see that particular form of harassment and where things are going. Laurie Adams.
Well, you know, I think there's all different kinds of forms of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, sexual violence, and you can see them perhaps on a continuum, but they have similar roots. The root is in the inequality, the power differential that there is between men and women, and between men and women of different classes and races. And people who have power over other groups, unfortunately, using all kinds of power to get what they want. And people have power over you, but we have power together. And that's what we're seeing with the Me Too movement, power with, also power within, our own confidence as women and power to do things. And I think Women for Women International's program brings women together so that in collectives, we have the power to together confront some of these abuses of power. And the root causes, whether it is someone touching you inappropriately at your workplace here in the United States, or whether it is a soldier violating you sexually as a weapon of war in Congo, are rooted in this inequality of power. I don't know that it's helpful to think about, is there one form that's worse? I think together we can say that all of these forms of harassment and violence are not acceptable. I also think it's important to recognize psychological harm. And I think the reality is that different forms of violence and harassment affect different women differently, partly depending on what we're used to or the resilience we've built. And so I also don't think it's useful to say, okay, that happened to her and it's worse than this over here. Sometimes psychological abuse, the words that people use and that diminishing and you're not worth anything, can be just as bad as being touched.
Well, Laurie, I think you make some excellent points. And by describing this phenomenon as on a continuum is very important. But is this power differential? So I'd like, Shelby Quast, for you to weigh in on this phenomenon.
And I think one of the things we see is really power and impunity. When power has been used in so many different settings, whether, you know, as I said, it's sexual assault in the military, often the most powerful picking on a more vulnerable person when they know they don't have the freedom to respond. But we see that in those power plays, it becomes very important. I've been working 30 years in the workforce, and people that I've grown up working with say, it's not, oh, what's your story? It is what's your story. It's not, do you have one? It is what's your story. We all have stories of that. And it was thought, I think, for a long time, part of joining the workforce, part of being in that game, that you had to put up with a certain amount. And people are starting to challenge that at the beginning. And I think one of the really key things for us is looking at adolescent girls. This starts early. It doesn't start only in the workforce. It doesn't start only in college campuses. We're seeing sexual harassment in grade school, in middle school. We're seeing it in communities, in families. And I think there's a big piece to changing this. So we've got the platform of saying Me Too and understanding the breadth of the problem, but now looking to what's the solution. What do we need to do to make real change? Equality Now is a legal advocacy organization, so we want to ensure that their laws and policies are in place. That's the punitive piece. But we also want to make sure there's a solution piece, that we change the way that we look at power, the way that we look at authority, the way that we look at impunity, and challenging that to actually stop the problem.
Turning back to you, Laurie, picking up on what Shelby said about that this phenomenon starts early in adolescence oftentimes. So let's take a look at some of the factors that have perpetuated these attitudes, the role of education, conditioning of men and women. And let's talk about U.S. culture, but I'm sure it extends to other cultures. To what extent do you think sometimes women are perhaps partly to blame insofar as women are mothers? And as we know, there's a phenomenon here in the United States, the so-called Jewish mother or Italian mother syndrome, where they often favor their boys, their sons, unwittingly perhaps, but that perpetuates this attitude that the boys can get away with things. To what extent do you think that's a factor, and what are other factors?
I do think absolutely the culture is an enormous factor, and women are often the holders and the passers down of culture. But looking deeper, what are some of the things that create and inform culture? And I do think it's useful to look at the economic factors. So as long as our societies reward men more economically, families will favor males because the men or the boys will bring more economic return back. So I have two interesting little vignettes about that. One is I was running a workshop in Kenya with some men, and they said, we now favor our daughters. Why? Because the last two decades have shown us that it is daughters who are more likely to keep in touch with us and support us in our old age. Now, this was a radical change from that particular culture in which usually the woman gets transferred to the other family that she marries into. But because she was staying in touch, the men now said, we value our daughters. In my own life, my mother-in-law used to favor my sons and her own son, my ex-husband, enormously. Then after many years of me being the one that sustained the family economically, I suddenly found her starting to bring me tea as well as my husband. And I thought, no, that's an interesting shift. And so I became almost like an honorary man because I was the breadwinner. And so I think we have to look at the hundreds of years of how our culture has been shaped by our economics. And part of the solution to shifting the culture is, in fact, shifting our economics. If the only way a woman can be valued is if she gets married, and to be married, she has to look beautiful, then we start to have all these norms of beauty that we have here in the U.S. You must look this way or that way in order to attract a man.
Very fascinating, Laurie. So let me turn to Shelby Quest for your take on some of the factors, whether cultural or economic.
I think that there's definitely an economic piece to this, and girls being seen as a commodity that costs the family, whereas boys are seen as income generators. The World Bank has a very interesting report called Women, Business, and the Law, and they measure the costs of these type of things, about what's the cost of sexual harassment, what's the cost of sexual violence, what's the cost of domestic violence in terms of what's the cost on the community, where should they be investing? And I think that becomes a very key piece of things. But the other side of it is the value of raising a family, that becomes valued. And you know, small vignette in my own life was when I went to law school, my husband then picked up the child care duties at night and put the children to bed and fed them, which was very different than the way he was raised. But valued, I was earning a degree to earn a living, become an income producer in our family, and he then was picking up a share of the household and child raising. And I think that equality and that balance and understanding that culture is something, and gender roles are something that are learned, and we can change them and we can shift them.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Laurie Adams. She's director and CEO of Women for Women International, and that's a global organization dedicated to promoting gender equality and helping women victims of war, and Shelby Quast, from whom you just heard. She's director of Equality Now, a nonprofit organization that promotes women's rights around the globe. And we're discussing the origins and implications of the Me Too movement. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Virginia Beach here in the United States, Dottie Holtz. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Laurie Adams, to talk about the global impact of this movement. It seems to have spread around the world. Given your vast international experience, particularly in the developing world, talk about the global impact, in your view, your personal and field experiences, particularly in Africa.
Well, it was interesting. I was in Nigeria in December, right about when Me Too was really going viral here in the United States. And I was with a workshop of, we call them change agents, women who graduate from our program who want to go on and spread the learning that they've gained about women's rights to the rest of the community. And I asked these change agents, so what are you doing to end gender-based violence in Nigeria? And what do you think of the Me Too movement? And they said, well, frankly, for us, we still need to come together in groups and we need to talk to people face to face, because if we were just to name our accuser in public, that's not going to change anything for us. We need to organize. And so I think the fact that it's gone global is most definitively giving power to all of us by being together. It's encouraging more women to come out. But there is a class issue here, right? Me Too hashtag is, by its very nature, something that requires access to social media. And the vast majority of the world's women who are subject to sexual harassment and abuse don't have access to social media. And so that old-fashioned and highly necessary ongoing organizing is very important. But I think the power of uplifting it to the media is to generate more support, more understanding, and build a global movement to bring about change.
Turning to you, Shelby, to build upon what Laurie said, certainly there seems to be a class issue. Some women, particularly in the developing world, don't have access to social media. But the problem remains. What other obstacles or unique challenges do you see for women, particularly in these patriarchal societies?
Accountability. And I think that even when we have strong laws and policies in place, actually being implemented across the system so that women and girls who experience sexual harassment, sexual violence, actually can hold perpetrators accountable. And part of that is really the government taking that forward, ensuring that the justice system is accessible, ensuring that the police are trained and understand that these are real issues that they must take forward. Same with educators in the education system. And the United Nations has a new, from 2015, the Sustainable Development Goals. And 193 countries around the world signed on to these goals. And those include safe workspaces. They include safe spaces to learn. And we need to really work at all levels. So absolutely at the grassroots, where we have many partners around the world, but ensuring that their concerns are brought up at the national level, the regional level, and again at the United Nations, so that those sustainable development goals are used to hold the countries accountable, to prioritize these types of issues, and ensure that those goals are reaching the lives of women and girls in those communities that are being most affected. So I think for me, accountability and prioritizing that accountability is a very key piece to taking this forward.
Well, back to you, Laurie, again, talking about whether in Africa or in other countries in the developing world, what are some of the obstacles, both cultural and legal, in your view, that would prevent women in those countries from moving forward as compared to here in the United States?
Well, I absolutely agree with Shelby that when you don't have a functioning state that is held accountable by its people, that makes it far more difficult. One of our trainers in the Democratic Republic of Congo gives a good example. As you may know, the Democratic Republic of Congo has been devastated by first hundreds of years of slavery, followed by being the private colony of King Leopold, followed by decades of dictatorship. And so there's never been a government that is actually accountable to its citizens and democratic. And so even when you pass a law against domestic violence, there isn't a mechanism to utilize that. So Honorata lives in the eastern part of Congo. The first thing that happened to her was the Rwandans who perpetrated the genocide came across the border. They kidnapped her from her family home. They held her as a sex slave for a year. These are one of the 100 groups of a militia who are living in the Congolese hills who are perpetrating this kind of sexual violence. Honorata finally manages to get away. She goes back home, but her husband's remarried, and so he doesn't accept her. So she starts to rebuild her life in Bukavu, which is a significant city. A year later, a different group of men enter her home, steal everything, rape her again. There's no accountability. There's nowhere for her to go. So she enters our program. She is able to then build a connection of support with other women who help her start up a business and help her rebuild the confidence and courage she needs to go forward. She has now gone on to be a trainer for us and trained 2,000 women. So she has incredible power and she can do a lot. However, there's no protection. And so even now, another group of militia could come along and destroy her life again. And so coming together, helping each other, providing social protection that the state doesn't provide when you don't have the rule of law is really important, but it does have its limits if you don't have a police force that is protecting you rather than attacking you, a military which is not attacking you, and services. Another group that we serve are the Yazidi women in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. This population was almost entirely wiped out through a genocide. And thousands of women were kept as sex slaves by ISIS. They need psychosocial support. They've been absolutely traumatized. They need to rebuild their families, but they also need to rebuild themselves. And obviously, when you have groups rampaging about like ISIS and you don't have protection, that makes it far, far, far more difficult than the situations that many of us face here. That's not to say there aren't some terrible situations in our own country, but those of us sitting here are not facing ISIS capturing us as sex slaves and do have some recourse to accountability, as Shelby said.
That's right. We have recourse, so we're far better off here in the United States and I'm sure in other European countries. Do you see any efforts or headway in this accountability direction, Shelby, vis-a-vis the United Nations, given the momentum now with the so-called hashtag MeToo movement that could help to ensure greater accountability and rule of law in some of these countries?
Well, yeah, and I think in the U.S. we all often want to say it's something that happens over there into these other countries. But one thing the MeToo movement did was actually unite U.S. women for the first time, I think, in a global movement, seeing themselves as part of this movement because of the backsliding we're beginning to see on women's rights in this country, the backsliding with sexual and reproductive rights, the backsliding on seeing impunity take place, sexual violence, sexual harassment, and this stand up now saying, wait a second, we need to protect this and we need to ensure that our own country and our own government is accountable because we have these mechanisms to take forward. So looking at the global issues, absolutely, there's work going forward. We work as a legal advocacy organization, so we want always trying to make sure there are laws in place, but then that those laws, once they're in place, that they're being implemented, that those barriers are being identified and broken down. So it has to happen, in my opinion, really at multiple levels at the same time. It's not linear. It's happening and has to happen in various places so that young girl who experiences something in Liberia and the young girl that experiences something in the United States. In the United States, 34 states don't have 18 as the minimum age of marriage for girls. We have issues here. Female genital mutilation happens in this country to girls that have been born here, live in the Midwest, Christian background. We certainly see sexual violence in the schools. We see it on college campuses. And those are different pieces of the same coin. So I think that we really need to be working to hold all governments accountable, and especially those that have systems in place that can show how it can work. We need to ensure that we are pushing that it is working. So I think we have a particular responsibility in this country.
Indeed, we have to hold governments accountable, institutions, and even at the individual level. So let's end it in that regard. Laurie Adams, I'd like you to talk about what you think some specific steps women anywhere in the world perhaps can and should take, because at the end of the day, we have to empower ourselves, know our value, our worth, and muster the strength to, whether it's documenting an incident if it occurs, making sure that it's reported, not fearing for that. What are some specific easy steps you think we can all take around the world?
Well, I think one of them really is to consider telling your own story of courage, your own Me Too story. I think I was encouraged by actually the women in Nigeria I had met who were telling their stories, and then also by the Me Too movement to begin to tell my story. So one, I think, is look at your own experiences and share them and start conversations. One way to do that is in your own community across different barriers of race and class, and another is to do so internationally. I believe really strongly in acting locally and globally. I think it's a really critical and exciting moment in history. We have a real opportunity to make a change. Let's keep pushing at this tipping point to bring about some of the really structural barriers that are in place.
And of course, Shelby, we can't leave out the men. There are good-willed men who would like to contribute and also take part in empowering women and changing attitudes and norms. The last word to you.
For me, key issues is to remove the shame that so often surrounds these issues, that women can speak freely. Remove the judgment. Quit victimizing the victim. So often we look at the role of a woman as opposed to the role of a perpetrator violating her rights. And the last thing I think that we need to really do as a community, men and women together, is not only ensure that we have equality and that we have equal rights in place, but that women claim those rights. They know them, they claim them, and that we really push for gender equality to really take advantage of this opportunity and ensure that we make change as opposed to just making noise.
We should know our rights and speak out. And on that optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Laurie Adams, Director and CEO of Women for Women International, and Shelby Quast, Director of Equality Now. Thanks to Andreas Van Dyke for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week. for another encounter on The Voice of America.